All right. Good morning, everybody. We're gonna continue today with E*TRADE. We have the new CEO, Mike Vesey. Welcome to the stage, my friend. This is, of course, Jeremy Campbell, the exchanges, brokers, and asset managers analyst here at Barclays, and great to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeremy. Great to be back at this conference.
Yeah. So Mike, we're gonna start off with a little bit of an audience response question first, maybe set the table for us, and then we'll kinda roll through some of these questions that we have for you. So I guess one, investors, if you wanna kinda grab the remote control in front of you and answer this, you know, what topics relating to E*TRADE do you expect to dominate your focus over the next 10-12 months here? One, rates. Two, share buybacks. Three, expense management. Four, organic balance sheet growth. Or five, sources of inorganic growth. I have an idea what this might look like. Clearly, interest rates are at the forefront of mind, but I think I heard an all of the above from the audience up here earlier too. So, with that as a backdrop here, I guess, you know, it's very kinda interesting times here for the broker segment. You know, the acquisitions, leadership changes, challenging bank rate backdrop, volatile markets. I guess at the highest level, Mike, how is E*TRADE kinda positioned for the environment we're currently in right now?
Yeah. These are indeed interesting times. I mean, we've seen markets with an 800-point move in the Dow. We've seen currency volatility return really for the first time in a decade. We've seen the VIX spike multiple times intraday, and we've seen an unyielding pressure on interest rates to move lower. Who would've thought we would live in a world where one of the leading investment banks would put out an index of presidential tweets and that a tweet could move the market in a way more than fundamental economic data that comes out every morning that used to be the event that moved the market for the day? So yeah, these are indeed very interesting times with a resurgence of a bit of volatility. But what's important is this is a time when our model truly shines. Let's look at each segment in turn. In our trading portion of our business, we provide the widest library of tools, solutions for today's active trader. Everything to help them find the opportunities, navigate the volatility, to take advantage of it, complex order types, execution, all the way through into what I think is the most important, risk management. We back that all with uncompromised service, the best service offering in the industry. On the investing side, for customers that are looking to do it completely on their own, we provide a wide library of commission-free ETFs and no-load, no-transaction fee mutual funds. But more importantly, we give them the best toolset in the marketplace to select from those funds to build the portfolio that they want. For customers that are looking for a more managed solution, we start with pre-built portfolios, progress to our robo-advisory, our core product, all the way to more advanced UMA and SMA products. For customers that truly want an advised solution, perhaps they have complex estate needs or tax needs, or they just want an individual relationship, we now offer advisor referral to advisors that we have carefully screened and are willing to refer our clients to who are looking for that side of our relationship with the build-out of our advisor services channel. Again, all of it backed by service that in this market is really valuable. When customers call in, they wanna talk to someone that understands not just the product but the markets that we're in. So it's a time for us to truly shine. Now, you brought up M&A. Anytime assets are in motion, we view it as an opportunity. There's going to be some customer that looks at it as a forced change and an opportunity to benchmark, to look at alternatives. They have to change. They should take a look and see what else is available. For us, it's about putting our value proposition front and center to that customer and making sure we've got an opportunity if they're really going to do some comparison shopping. In terms of management changes across the industry, it's also an opportunity. Anytime there's strategy shift, anytime there's sort of drift in the competitive set, it's an opportunity for us. I could assure you with this management change, there is no loss of focus, no loss of mission, no loss of resolve. We are focused on our strategy and hard at work every day.
Maybe that's a good segue here. It's a, you know, first of all, congratulations on the new role.
Thank you.
But as you're taking this seat, you know, what are your top priorities as you're stepping into this role?
Well, we've done a lot over the past few years. So let me frame it there, and then I could talk a little bit about where we're going. We've restored our brand to its challenger status in the marketplace, an important item for us for growth. More importantly, we've reclaimed the mantle of leadership in our trading segment. Very important for us overall, especially in the derivative component, which is an important growth element. It's not just me saying that. Kiplinger's rated us number one of the brokers, and it really shows and is a testament to all the work that we've done over the past few years in improving our platform, improving our experience, and improving our service. We have always been a firm that has placed technological and operational excellence at the center of everything we do. It is going to be even more of a focus under my leadership. It's something that I think is the real way to drive advantage and to win in the future. As far as other priorities, we are hard at work on our advisor services integration to deliver on the promise of our advisor services unit, where we see a compelling growth opportunity. Looking at other parts of our business, it's really the top priority is to continue what we're doing. Leverage our Epic brand, take our digital ethos, and continue to drive the evolution of product to break down the barriers between Wall Street and Main Street and empower today's investors and traders in the marketplace.
We'll get to rates and client cash dynamic in a minute here, but I guess let's just start with technology since you emphasized that in that last point. I guess what are your biggest areas of investment, and how do you think about that, the path towards innovation on a going forward basis?
My goal and mission in technology is to really evolve our technology delivery to truly empower our business to deliver enhancements and innovation in a truly nimble and scalable way. We're good at this today, but I think we need to be great at it to win the future. And so we're making the changes we need to drive that evolution forward. To that end, I brought in a new CIO, a real heavy hitter, who is focused on modernization efforts throughout his career. Now, let's talk a little bit about sort of what that really means. In terms of, we're a company that invented this space. We take great pride in it. Our technology is at the roots of the industry. Over time, we've acquired a number of companies and integrated them seamlessly into our platform. We've built out a complex ecosystem of product. It's no surprise that some level of re-engineering, some level of focus on modernization is always necessary. We're focusing on the latest in cloud technology to truly leverage our infrastructure. We're focusing on robotic process automation to truly deliver higher degrees of efficiency and exploring new areas such as AI and machine learning overall throughout the company. Technology is clearly a priority at E-Trade. It always has been and will continue to be in the future. And when we look at innovation, we're not going to focus on what I would call PR-led innovation efforts to just get a press release out. We focus on innovating and driving our product to really produce for our end customers something that enhances their experience in the markets every day.
And then we think about like the corporate solutions business, and especially like equity comp being a bigger piece of the pie here for, you know, with Morgan Stanley's purchase of Solium and a lot of more interest in the space overall. I guess you guys have a pretty leading position today, but how are you going to keep fend off these kind of competitive threats that are coming in here now that some bigger money is kind of coming in the door?
Sure. Sitting here today, we are light years ahead in this business. There's a simple reason for that. Our model cannot be beat. We start on the technology side with a platform that truly makes the life of the stock plan administrator easier. We back that with a service and an experience offering where our business is filled with people that have actually done this job at corporations that understand the details that stock plan administrators have to work with every day. And then we combine that with a participant experience that is the most compelling in the industry. Gone are the days where equity comp is an elite benefit for the C-suite. For most of the companies in our portfolio, it extends down through middle layers. For many, it's for all employees. A compelling participant experience is key, and the digital delivery of that solution is key to success in the business. Now, in terms of the product itself, we are truly taking the analog problems of stock plan administrators and solving them with a digital solution. We understand that every stock plan is different. We will make technology resources, engineering resources available to our customers to deliver true customization of their plan. We have launched new enhancements in reporting, in tax administration, and we are now the first to offer a fully automated 10b5-1 program, So it's no longer a paper manual setup for every 10b5-1 that a plan wants. They can set up as many as they want. We've heard that the market demand was for more than just 4 or 5. We've given them the ability to set up and do it in a fully automated way. It's those type of investments that are not just maintaining our leadership, but extending our leadership overall.
And then, you know, I think the question we get commonly from clients, and I think you guys have done a pretty good job trying to pull back the curtain a little bit, but how does the corporate services kind of division can really manifest in operating metrics and your financial results over time?
The clear way this business drives value to us as a company is through the acquisition of customers that come through this channel. Sitting here today, 1/3 of our new accounts come from this channel. About 1/3 of our client cash comes from this channel. Simply put, the faster we can grow the channel, the faster we grow as a company overall. And we've done a great job growing it. A few years ago, 3 years back, we were about $150 billion in total assets, in total stock plan assets. Today, we're about $260 billion. To put that number in context, the annual proceeds from those stock plans were about $18 billion in that period to $30 billion now, an increase of $12 billion of annual proceeds. We retain about 15% of proceeds 12 months after vest. I think that's an important point. I think it often gets missed, is that there is a compounding nature to the growth of this business. When we sign a stock plan, we get a block of assets. But every year, there's a new set of grants, a new set of vests, a new set of sales, and an amount of proceeds that are moving through. These are growing companies. They're growing their employee headcount in the economy. Their stock valuations are hopefully going up as well. All of that translates to growth from this channel. I think the compounding nature of the growth in this channel is sometimes overlooked because it gets looked as just as an asset acquisition, not something that has an evergreen nature. On the cash side, it's compounding as well. It's not that these customers are just selling some stock and then forgetting they sold it and leaving it in cash. It's the statistics of it. It's 1 million accounts that are cycling through stock grants in any given period that are flowing through our system. They're going to use that cash for something, but it's just the statistics of it that drive the overall cash to a higher level. That compounding often gets missed in the market today.
Sure. And then maybe I think the one area here is the question is, well, can you retain these clients as core E-Trade clients? So maybe in the context of, like, you know, organic growth and asset flows, you know, maybe it's worth spending a moment talking about the advisor services segment, you know, in conjunction with the corporate plan, and maybe how this referral network factor kind of plays into the overall complex a little bit.
Sure. We have set up a referral network to advisors that we carefully screen overall. Now, asset growth isn't just about advisor, but I'll come back to advisor. Start with, it's about a complete ecosystem of product. It's about what I talked about earlier. It's about having the products for the complete do-it-yourselfer all the way through to managed solutions and then to an advisor referral relationship. Advisor referrals gives us a distribution force that doesn't have to work for us, that we can actively partner with. That gives us a distribution to go against participants in the stock plan business and offer them the compelling services that those carefully screened advisors provide. When we looked at our business a few years ago, we saw a set of outflows, not just in the corporate services segment, but also just in our core business. Customers grow up with us, they scale with us over their financial life, but at some point, they may look to an advisor. We want to be able to provide that relationship. We want to be able to capture that business. There's no reason why we shouldn't be doing that, and that's what led us to the TCA acquisition and the building out of E-Trade Advisor Services, which is a core priority of the company right now.
And then, you know, maybe we'll just kind of move over here a little bit to the client cash side. You know, in the second quarter, you guys began tactically utilizing your sweep programs to kind of move cash off your balance sheet, free up capital for share repurchases. You know, given that rates are clearly top of mind for everybody and not only your stock, but the entire, you know, financials complex more broadly speaking, can you maybe just describe why you're making this shift and how, you know, you envision it impacting the P&L over time?
Sure. We set up a mechanism to move deposits off balance sheet for the simple reason of providing our clients additional FDIC insurance up to $1.25 million. What it allows is for us to use a variety of external banks as well as our internal banks in setting up our sweep program. What that also allows, though, is us to be able to reduce the size of our internal banks and move cash off our balance sheet. We wouldn't have thought of to do this looking back a year or so at a different environment, a different yield curve. But ultimately, given where rates have traded, given where the Fed funds is at, it became quite clear that if we sold off $4.5 billion of our lowest yielding securities, we could accelerate capital return back to our investors and announce a historic buyback program in terms of both its size and the time frame in which we were going to conduct the buyback. It was clearly the right thing to do for our owners. It was clearly drove EPS accretion and ROE accretion. And I think most importantly, it's seamless to our customers. The banks are already in the waterfall program. It's really an internal mechanic of being able to move that cash from our balance sheet to another bank's balance sheet that is seamless to our customers overall.
And you know, you mentioned you sold the lowest yielding securities. You guys booked a loss on it, so it should tell you kind of what that backdrop looked like from a yield perspective. But what's the next layer? Is there more opportunity to kind of, you know, move stuff off the balance sheet and free up even more capital after this phase one is kind of completed?
Well, it really depends on the environment. I mean, if you think about kind of, you know, where we are from a position in the securities portfolio overall, we sold the lowest yields out of AFS, but we also have floating rate securities in the portfolio as well, so that those are going to move. Prepayment speeds will also affect it. So there's always a degree of reoptimization, but the transaction that we undertook in Q2 was clearly optimal. So we will always be doing that math to look for sort of the optimal way to generate value for our owners overall. From a balance sheet perspective for right now, the best way to think about it is it's going to be flat to slightly down overall as we work through this buyback period. We've taken amount of capital from our bank up to the parent company to deploy in the buyback. We are holding the bank's balance sheet relatively steady. That means we're holding the corporation's balance sheet relatively steady, and therefore deploying all of that capital back to our owners.
And we'll just queue up the next audience response question here. So for you guys, grab your clicker. Question two. All right, so for the audience in here, for your personal accounts, how's your weighting of cash changed over, wait, let me get that back up. How has your weighting of cash change in your personal account over the past 12 months? Increased, decreased, or stayed the same? So for most, it's increased, and people are kind of building up dry powder here at some point with a pretty even split between decrease and stay the same. So kind of in that context, you know, as we think about your moving off the balance sheet to pursue buybacks and freeing up capital, you know, you also spoke a little bit about flexibility to bring these back on balance sheet at some point in time. So maybe kind of what conditions would we have to see for those to kind of come back on the balance sheet? And, you know, let's say, you know, the rates narrative had flipped completely, right? December, we were talking about how many they were going to raise. First quarter, it was going to be flat forever. And now we're talking about how many cuts we're going to get. So how quickly could you bring these back on balance sheet if conditions, you know, warrant at some point?
Sure. I mean, simply put, the decision to bring it back on balance sheet will require either an improved valuation in the stock or a steeper yield curve. So better investment returns relative to what we can earn off balance sheet, but stock valuation also plays into that. From a mechanics perspective, there's nothing preventing us from moving this, nothing structural preventing us from moving these balances back on. It is simply a phone call from our Treasury Department to our sweep administrator, and the re-onboarding of the deposits can proceed almost immediately. So what becomes the limiting factor? It's the capital. It's the capital that we're deploying to share buybacks. We would then need to internalize that capital to grow the balance sheet. So it's a decision that can be made really at a moment's notice if we feel that it's the right thing to do. There's really nothing to stop us from changing course if that's what the opportunity set presents to us.
Gotcha. And then I guess, you know, shifting to the long-term goals, I mean, toward the end of last year, you set out a $7, you know, EPS goal by 2023. But obviously the market is completely, you know, flipped on us here, as we just talked about, right? So how does the shift in this rates backdrop impact that target, and kind of what would it take to get there in this new, perhaps lower for longer type of environment?
Yeah, when we put out the greater than $7 target with a greater than 20% ROE, we examined and stressed multiple different scenarios and relationships. On the business side, we looked at the offset between customer cash growth and trading volumes, and we've seen live that play out. We've been in a market still with significant amount of net buying. That net buying has put pressure on the level of cash growth we expected, but it's been more than offset in trading volumes. It's been offset in trading volumes, margin, stock lending, all of making it up for lower than initially expected cash growth. And so that sort of business offset has played through as we expected. On the rate side, we looked at a variety of different rate environments. We didn't look at this one in particular with term rates rallying and moving as much as they have, but we looked at a variety of different Fed fund scenarios and what they ultimately might look like. And the model holds up and continues to produce $7. Sitting here today, if I take the yield curve that we're encountering at this moment, freeze it forward through time, I feel very good about reaching the $7. Now, that said, the model is not magic. If Fed funds continues to go down, if we continue to see that happen in a way where the curve stays relatively flat, so term rates track lower with it, it will become increasingly difficult to hit the $7 overall. In that environment, we feel that we will still be differentiating ourselves both from capital return and the ability to grow our business overall and still deliver compelling earnings.
Let's keep ARS number three here and see what the audience has to think about Fed funds rate. Currently target range is 2%-2.25%. Where do you think expectations are for the Fed funds to be in the next 12 months? One, you know, above 2.5%, all the way down to six is below 1.5% here. Big winner here is between 1.5% and 1.75%. I guess kind of to your point here, instead of freezing the curve going forward here, I know we're not asking about yield curve dynamics. I'm not sure the Barclays technology system can handle you guys punching in a curve scenario here for you guys. But Mike, given kind of the audience response question here, what are we kind of looking at from a trajectory to that $7?
Yeah, look, it's going to really depend on the environment we're in with that market move. A move to 150-175 is not a severe recession, and it's not a huge move in Fed funds. If that generates some increased inflation expectations and we see some normalization of term rates, it's very possible in that scenario that $7 will be readily achievable. If term rates just track lower with it and the curve stays inverted, as it is, it's going to be increasingly difficult. We will adjust and respond accordingly to the market environment we're in to do the best thing to drive value for our owners.
And then another goal you kind of initially set out was this 50% op margin target by 2020 and a mid-50s margin by 2023. I guess, where are we today on those goals? And you know, is there an ability to pull back on that expense lever a bit given kind of the more challenging kind of revenue environment?
Sure. You know, on the Q2 earnings call, we talked about 2020. We clearly are not forecasting a 50% operating margin anymore. The decision to move securities off our balance sheet, to move off balance sheet, comes at the expense of some revenue generation to generate EPS growth and ROE growth overall.
Yeah.
That trade-off moves us away from the 50%. It's a shift in strategy. We talked about that a bit, and it's also because of where the rate environment has emerged.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to strip out needed investment in the company for long-run growth and efficiency to deliver on the operating margin target in 2020. And that gets to our longer operating margin target. The value of new growth into the company is still coming on at a marginal operating margin that greatly exceeds the operating margin where we're at. Simply put, the faster we grow as a company, the faster our operating margin expands. That's a great position to be in. We think focusing on growth over the period of time will continue to drive operating margin expansion, and we feel really good about reaching the mid-50s by 2023. What that is going to require, though, in this immediate environment is a focus on cost containment. Not so much expense reductions, as you say, but on containing our costs year-over-year at a level that we have not shown investors historically, but is a program that we are actively putting in place.
Gotcha. And then, you know, we noticed the audience has kind of been building cash, right? You know, maybe we'll talk a little bit about the cash sorting. I mean, what are the trends right now with E*TRADE customers out there from a cash sorting perspective as, you know, customers perhaps look for more yield and and maybe look at something like a money market type fund instead of a kind of more pure cash deposit?
It starts with having a complete set of product offerings for your customers. We make a wide variety of product available, starting with our own bank savings product. Our premium savings product pays a 1.75% rate. It's available to any customer. It's right on our website. It's not hidden in any way. We have money funds available for purchase, a wide variety of them. There are short duration and cash-like ETFs that are available, commission-free from us if customers want to use those. And we have the most capable bond desk in the industry that many of our customers will call into for tax strategies, ladders, municipals, things like that. It's about having the right set of products for your customers to invest their cash. Now, looking at sort of the sweep cash, what have we seen? Well, we have seen in this sort of increase in rate cycle exactly what we would have expected, a high degree of inelasticity or a high degree of rate insensitivity, exactly as we would have expected it. Less than 1% of our customers have purchased a money fund. So the degree of rate insensitivity is very much intact, and as we've expected. We have not seen a high degree of what others have called client cash sorting. Now, looking at that a little bit deeper, why is it? And it's the exact reasons we've always talked about. At a relatively low wallet share on our account base, with a mid-teens percentage of client cash, this is not the cash as an asset class that gets discussed very often. It's truly the frictional cash of the account. It's the dividend and interest that got deposited last week that is yet to be redeployed in the market. It's the proceeds from the sale of a stock that occurred where the trading client is waiting for an opportunity to redeploy it. So it's not the cash asset weight. It's really the frictional cash within the brokerage account. And so that rate insensitivity remains intact.
More dry powder than
yes.
Cash as an investment gadget. And then, I know you guys put out your metrics this morning here. I apologize, I've been up here hosting exchange conversations at this point. Is there anything that you wanted to call out on that regarding kind of some of the topics we've just talked about here?
Oh, sure. It was our best August ever. And I think it speaks volumes to what we've done in the active trader segment and the platform that we have out in the marketplace. 285,000 DARTs overall, 100,000 derivative DARTs, third month of 35% derivative share to the total DART population, so really showing very clearly the delivery on our strategy within the trading space.
And then just, let's talk about M&A a little bit in more detail. Obviously, Schwab just recently made a move and kind of buying into the USA brokerage platform here. As it relates to E-Trade, how does the landscape look to you? What does the current environment look like? And how does your stock price kind of influence whatever approach you might take toward, a view on M&A going forward?
The best way to think about M&A overall is to look at the acquisitions we've done. If you take the last acquisition, we acquired about 1 million accounts from Capital One. That is largely just a block of scale. Now we're putting a better platform, a better experience, a better engagement model in front of those customers. So we do expect revenue lift from that customer pool as well, but largely one should think of that as a scale acquisition. If you look at what we did with TCA, completely different. It's largely a strategic acquisition. It's a small acquisition overall that opens up a very important growth channel for the company in the long run, a growth channel that we are making the right set of investments in right now. So an acquisition that's highly strategic in nature. If you look at OH, go back a few years, it's actually both. It's an important block of scale in the active trader component. Some of the best derivative customers we have came from OH. But looking at it more clearly, it's also highly strategic. It gave us the underpinnings to relaunch our trading platform and came with the talent to do that across the company. So that one falls in both buckets. So as we look at M&A strategy, we would consider deals across that space. Scale deals don't come up very often, but whenever one does, we're going to focus on it. And if we can get it at a compelling price, we will certainly move forward. On the strategic side, it's what can open up growth vectors for us as a company that today we can't open organically or would require a level of investment that would make it unattractive.
And then in that second kind of vein too, I guess, it's like with one approach you take in having a smaller kind of wealth arm, obviously, versus your primary competitors out there has been the referral network and the advisor platform. But in the M&A context, would that preclude you at all from pursuing If an asset became available, is either an acquisition or a merger of equals in that wealth space to try to, you know, more bolster that on an in-house type of basis?
I think it depends on a lot of factors around what the particular property is, how it could be monetized. In short, our referral program allows us to get a scalable amount of a significant amount of economics in a very scalable way. You know, if you think about earning the referral fee plus the custody fee plus what you earn on the cash, but you're not incurring any of the overhead of the distribution model of the larger space, carrying your own cost structure, it's going to allow you to scale in a way to add an enormous amount of value without having to take on the expense structure of that overall. We like that trade-off very much.
Got it. And then I think we'll just do the last two audience questions here. All right. Are you guys currently involved in E-Trade stock? One, yes, overweight. Two, yes, market weight. Three, yes, underweight or net short. Or four, not involved at all. So currently 30% of the audience is involved in overweight, and about 57% is kind of on the sidelines here. And that leads us to the final question. Is that
good to see? We have a lot of prospects here.
There you go. Well, over the next 12 months, do you plan on changing your position here? So one is yes, increase. Two is yes, decrease. Or three, stay the same. So pretty evenly split between increasing here or keeping the same. So I guess you want to respond to this? It seems like a pretty okay setup for you guys at this point here. And then, you know, just maybe the last couple here, you know, discussing around trading commissions is, you know, in this rate backdrop especially has subsided. But, you know, one of your competitors did note they saw potential pressure on pricing in the derivatives complex. Do you expect any real kind of paradigm shifts in that derivatives kind of pricing ecosystem at all going forward?
Today's derivative trader is one of the most value is the most value conscious segment, but it's value beyond price. Our derivative traders are actively engaging with the platform. They're using the tool set. They're using it to find trade opportunities in the derivative space. They're using it to test those trades in paper trading. They're using it to chart the trades and look at them on a historical basis. They're using all the complex order types we offer to execute the trades, superior execution quality, and again, most importantly, a risk management set that allows them to manage that position overall. They value the tool set. They also value the service offering. Our derivative traders call in to a specialist team in our Chicago office, many of whom are former floor traders, people who truly have the expertise in the derivative markets. So when they call in, they're talking to a person who understands their strategy, not a person who's just trained on the platform, but a person who understands what they're trying to do in the marketplace. All of that, we need to get a lot of value from. They're not going to give that up just to save a little bit of money on the commission side. Now, overall, you know, when we do see movements in the commissions on derivative trades that sort of affect our overall CPT, it's largely just the ebb and flow of contracts per trade based on whatever strategy is in place in the market at that time. And we can see movements in that. And so there is a bit of volatility, but I don't think there's any paradigm shift.
Gotcha. And then I guess with that, we'll pause here and see if there's any kind of questions from the audience. So if you have one, please raise your hand and we will get you the microphone. If not, I'm happy to kind of continue here for a little bit longer. So, right, doesn't look like we have any takers at this point. So I think kind of toward the end here, Mike, let's talk a little bit about kind of the threats coming into the industry. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we think about, you know, there's kind of a few different avenues of competitive threats, right? We have, actually on this Wednesday, I'm hosting wealth technology panels with, you know, Betterment, Wealthfront, and Personal Capital, and those guys. You have, you know, obviously Robinhood is kind of nascent and growing, but you also have pretty big money making some big investments here, like JP Morgan and you invest. You know, how do you kind of envision the disruption or not and kind of the evolution of these other kind of entrants getting into the more retail-facing side of the business?
Yeah, let's take a few of them in turn. You start with JPMorgan. That's got a lot of attention across the industry. Obviously, JPMorgan brings a tremendous amount of resources to bear. The You Invest app today has fairly limited functionality compared to the wide breadth of product that we make available to our customers. As such, at this moment in time, we don't see it as really a competitive disruption in the set. It offers some pretty basic trading capabilities, but nothing to what in comparison to what we or the established players are really offering. But we've seen this model before. We've seen wirehouses start into the space and invest progressively over time and build out capability. Some have done it well, some have done it not so well. We are going to watch very carefully as JPMorgan evolves their product strategy over time, and we are going to respond. We've got a great product today and a great strategy. We're going to continue to deliver and innovate and drive forward for our customers. If you look at Robinhood, I do admire the elegance and sleekness of their interface. But it's pretty easy to be elegant and sleek when you only do one thing. They offer a very limited set of capabilities to their customers compared to the extreme breadth of product that we're offering. We've got some of the best designers in the world always looking to drive a more compelling user experience in our platform overall, but the sheer breadth of our product makes it more difficult. I would also say that today's investors understand that free is not really free. That if something's free, you are probably the product overall. Execution quality matters. Our traders know the value of a good fill, and they know that they can spend far more money on a trade that's so-called free if they're not getting that superior execution quality overall. We have always felt that a transparent model that makes our pricing clear to our customers and our approach to the market in a very clear and transparent way is the best way to do business. It's gotten us here. It's continuing to grow our firm today. That's the strategy we're going to continue.
And I think in that vein, too, as you kind of look at the landscape here, are we just going to see more rollouts of these types of products that end up kind of going by the wayside or looking like orphan type products, or is kind of consolidation a potential kind of in this industry right now?
If you look back, there have been free trade offers in the past. There have been new approaches to investing. There have certainly been a proliferation of different robo products with different niches. I'm not saying that there's no room to disrupt a niche within the space, but what is a product and what is a company? We are a breadth of products. We are an ecosystem of products across a lot of different customer needs. We look at those customer needs and we drive forward and evolve. Sure, we study the competitive set. We look at what they're doing. We examine what niche they might be targeting or how they might be acquiring customers or moving in the marketplace. And we learn from that. But overall, we today are providing an incredible value to our customers across a wide range of products in various segments of the market.
Great. Well, if there's no client questions here, I think we're going to leave it at that. So please join me in thanking Mike and E-Trade for being here. Thanks.